Welcome to today's program, titled International Trade Secrets and Non-Compete Law Update. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Juan Lee, Daniel Hart, and Ming Henderson. You may now begin.
Good morning, or good afternoon, or good evening, depending on when and where in the world you're listening to this webinar. My name is Dan Hart. I'm a partner in the Atlanta office of Seyfarth Shaw, and it's my privilege to welcome you to this, the third installment in our 2015 Trade Secrets webinar series. Over the next 60 minutes or so, we're going to provide you with an update on trade secrets and non-compete law in the international context, with a particular focus on Europe and China. And to help you navigate through these issues, we're delighted to have some of our resident experts with us today. I'll be joined today by Ming Henderson, a partner in Seyfarth Shaw's London office, and Juan Lee, a partner in Seyfarth Shaw's Shanghai office. And the slide on the screen lists our aims for today. To get started, I'll briefly discuss the state of non-compete and trade secrets law in the U.S. and hopefully set the stage for the rest of our discussion. Ming will then discuss the key rules for protection in Europe by comparison to the U.S., and then we'll focus more specifically on principles, current trends, and developments in the U.K., France, and Germany. Juan Lee will then discuss latest developments in non-compete and trade secrets law in China. Ming will then provide an update on the European Commission's proposed directive on trade secrets protection in the EU. And finally, I'll provide what I hope are some practical tips to help multinational employers protect their trade secrets and confidential information across multiple countries. Now, with no further ado, let's get started on our first topic. As I already mentioned, in the next few minutes, Ming will discuss key rules for non-compete and non-disclosure agreements in Europe. But before we talk about Europe, it may be helpful to consider briefly the state of the law in the U.S. so that we'll have a frame of reference for the rest of our discussion today. As an initial matter, it's important to note that U.S. law about non-compete agreements, as well as law about trade secrets, is principally a matter of state law rather than federal law. I'm going to provide some overarching observations about general trends in the U.S., but I do so with the big caveat that the applicable law can and does dramatically vary from state to state. An important distinction of U.S. law is the at-will nature of most employment relationships here in the U.S. There's no requirement in any state that employers provide their employees with employment contracts for any particular duration, and the vast majority of employees in the U.S. are considered at-will employees. As a result, most non-compete and non-disclosure covenants here in the U.S. are included in standalone agreements rather than in full-fledged employment contracts. And because of the at-will nature of most employment in the U.S., consideration is a big issue here in the U.S. Is it enough simply to provide employees with at-will employment, or do employers need to provide something else of value in order to bind employees to a non-compete or non-disclosure covenant? And the states take different approaches. A slight majority of states take the approach that continued at-will employment is enough consideration for a non-compete agreement. But the trend is definitely away from that approach, and an increasing number of states are saying that something beyond continued at-will employment is needed. Either way, it's a state-by-state approach. The same issue applies to terminations. Either party can terminate an at-will employment relationship at any time, as long as the reason for doing so is not an illegal one, such as discrimination or retaliation. And so that begs the question, if an employer can terminate an at-will employee, can the employer also enforce a non-compete against the terminated employee? And here again, the states take different approaches. Some say yes, and some say no. An even bigger issue in the U.S. is whether an employer can enforce a true non-compete covenant at all. And by a non-compete covenant, I'm referring here specifically to a covenant that prohibits an employee from being employed by a competitor, as opposed to a covenant that simply prevents the employee from soliciting employees or customers. And again, the states take different approaches. In the vast majority of states, non-compete covenants are permitted, as long as they are reasonably limited in time, geography, and scope. But in a handful of states, most notably California, true non-competes are prohibited altogether. And finally, in the U.S., employers generally are free to simply withdraw or waive non-compete agreements if they choose not to enforce them against a specific employee. Now, there's one important caveat to that. If an employer selectively enforces its non-compete covenants, it may have more difficulty getting a court to enforce its covenants when it really matters, but employers might decide not to enforce their non-competes against a specific employee for a variety of reasons, and they're entitled to do so. And with that, I'll hand it over to Ming to discuss Europe by contrast.
Thank you, Dan. Yes, I think it's very helpful to have that background from a U.S. perspective. And as most of you will know by now, at-will employment is not something that you find outside of the U.S., and particularly not in Europe. So, therefore, employees will generally have an employment contract, and non-compete covenants will usually be included in an employment contract. They can sometimes be in a standalone agreement or collective bargaining agreements, but most of the time it also needs to be in the employment contract itself. So the drafting of these clauses are a key element of the hiring process when you're considering whether or not you want a non-compete attached to the particular employee you're hiring. The second point that Dan was referring to was the particular limitations of the non-compete, and certainly I think the parallel with Europe is interesting there, and we'll be going into further detail later on, but it's important to know that the duration and the scope of the non-compete needs to be clearly defined. In terms of the consideration, Again, you'll find that in Europe, consideration is necessary. However, how that consideration is considered will be very different from one country to another. And in particular, it turns out that some of the European countries actually require financial compensation for the non-competes to be valid. So, most countries consider that non-competes are potentially valid in Europe. There are exceptions, and our recommendation is always to still avoid sort of general insertions of such non-compete for all employees, but they would generally be considered potentially valid. If we were looking at countries outside of Europe, you should know, for example, that in India, the non-competes are generally not valid by contrast. And then the last point about the non-competes is whether the withdrawal of the non-compete is subject to a specific timeline. This, again, will be very different within Europe, but you should consider that generally there is a timeline because it is considered that the non-compete has a constraint on employees, and therefore it is important that they are informed in due time. So moving on to this slide, what we're trying to summarize here is that, well, Europe is actually doesn't have a single approach for non-compete. In fact, it is quite the opposite. But there are some common trends, which we've tried to summarize here. So first of all, the non-compete will have a reasonable duration, a reasonable geographical scope, and reasonable in terms of the activities. It needs to be justified in view of the employee's role. Again, a very junior employee may not be bound by a non-compete, whereas employees in senior roles or in critical position, given their knowledge of company information and know-how and trade secret, will justify that. The general principle is that there should be non-compete should be defending the company's legitimate interest. So, of course, that is a very broad definition, and you'll find that it's very case-specific depending on the industry, depending on the country, but it is something you need to bear in mind. An additional element that needs to be remembered is whether or not the non-compete needs to be in local language. That is going to be very much the same as whether the employment contract itself needs to be in local language. France, for example, needs to be in French, whereas in Germany it will depend on the understanding of English of the particular employee, though the recommendation is to have a local language clause, or at least a bilingual English-German clause. Consideration, I very briefly touched on that earlier on. I think just in terms of the key elements that you need to remember here is that the consideration may not always be a payment. It's not always required. It is required in Germany, in Spain, in Italy, and Sweden as well. The value of that consideration will vary depending on, for example, the collective bargaining agreement or what has been agreed in the employment contract. And then finally, if the employer decides to waive the non-compete, then obviously the financial consideration will not be due. But there are important rules there in terms of how that is waived. So just to go in a bit further detail, let's look at France, the UK, and Germany. These are the most it's what we find our clients are generally interested in terms of the non-compete. So starting with the UK, what's interesting about the UK is that financial consideration is necessary, but it doesn't, consideration is necessary, but it doesn't need to be in the form of a financial payment. There can be other considerations such as, for example, a promotion or the receipt of a bonus payment. In exceptional circumstances, it can be the continued consideration of employment, but that is not usually the best practice. So you always try and tie in the non-compete with some other event. In terms of the duration, the UK is probably one of the more conservative countries in Europe. Our clients often want a non-compete for 12 months, two years. That doesn't really work. In the UK, typically, you'd be looking at a number of months, and it will be, so it could be 3, 6, 9 months, and it will be very a fact specific, so it will be very much based on a precise analysis of what are the business interests, what are the particular skills of the individual, what the company needs to protect, and how long it needs to be able to, replace the individual re-engage another employee and keep the employee out of the market. What's important is that the non-compete isn't a restriction of trade. Now, moving on to France, the non-competes have to have a financial consideration. It ranges from 30 to 60% average salary payable for the duration of the non-compete, so not as an amount during the employment contract. That would be acceptable in Spain, for example, but it's not acceptable in France. And there's a lot of rules in terms of how that average salary is calculated. Germany is also one of the more difficult countries in terms of the non-compete. There needs to be a minimum of 50% salary. What's very important to remember in Germany is that if you decide that you want to waive the non-compete, you need to give the employee 12 months' notice unless he expressly agrees to the waiver of the non-compete. And the reason why this is in place is because basically employers are being discouraged to include non-competes where it's not strictly necessary. So it's possible to waive it without that notice period, for example, if you are signing a settlement agreement with the employee after the termination, but otherwise it does restrict the employer quite a lot. So the preferred approach in Germany is probably to move to garden leave. So as we're dealing with an update, and some of you may have attended our previous webinar on international trade secrets, we thought we'd focus on the current trends. There hasn't been any, major changes in the UK in the last 12 months. There has been one interesting case where there was a non-compete that was restricting an employee for 12 months, and that was previously considered as a rather long period, but it's interesting to see that there has been in recent months some decisions where the non-compete was for 12 months. Another interesting trend in the UK is that if the clause isn't properly drafted, then it's not the role of the employer to make the clause understandable, or rather to correct any poor drafting of the clause. It's interesting that if the clause is clear, then the judge will not try and change it, even if the clause doesn't actually have any commercial use. In this particular case, there was an employee that was bound by a non-compete. However, he was not allowed to compete. Not allowed to be employed by a company that was using the same software as his previous employer. But the trick was actually his previous employer was the only company that was actually using that software and using that product. So there was no use to that non-compete. And even though it was clear the intention of the parties not to draft such a clause, the fact that that is how it was interpreted meant that the courts didn't feel that they had to jump in to correct the wording. Some other recent cases are a very useful reminder for non-competes. The important thing to remember is that the value of the non-compete has to be assessed at the beginning of the relationship, not necessarily at the end in the UK. So if at the time the employee entered the employment contract, if at that time the non-compete was not valid, then it will not be enforceable later on. So I think the key takeaway message for the UK is that the clauses are to be interpreted very strictly by the courts, and that if there's any ambiguity or if there's any way for the clauses to become unenforceable, that the courts will quite happily strike them out. Moving on to France. Now, France is, as we said, is a country where the non-compete can be slightly longer. It can be for 2 years. However, it needs to be associated with a payment. If the payment is not made, then immediately the clause is no longer enforceable. It becomes void. And if the financial compensation is too low, then the judge does have the power to review the financial compensation. For example, there has been some disputes regarding how average salary is calculated. If it's below what the requirements of the collective bargaining agreement is, then the judge can force the company to increase the payment. There's been a lot of decisions recently regarding the withdrawal of the non-compete. Under French law, a non-compete clause needs to be withdrawn within a particular period. And if the employer has passed that period, then the clause remains valid. I think the view is that, obviously, because employees are receiving the final compensation for the non-compete, it's in their interest for them to receive that a payment. Although if they do decide to join a competitor, then they would no longer be entitled to the financial compensation. So the recent decisions have been around when the withdrawal needs to take place. Is it from the term of the employment contract, so the effective departure date, or is it early on? The courts have tried to they always seem to take the side of the employee there, which means that the release by the employer needs to be as soon as possible. But interestingly, if the release needs to take place within 8 days under the employment contract, there has been a decision that says that waiving the non-compete earlier is not necessarily valid. So you should really be extremely careful when looking at the particular wording of the waiver of the non-compete. Now, other recent developments still talking about France. Even if there is a company shutdown, so even if the company completely ceases its activity, the employer is still bound by the non-compete, so the financial payment needs to be made by the to the employee, which is slightly surprising because obviously the purpose of the clause is very limited. In the Netherlands, there's an interesting development. Since January 2015, non-competes are not authorized in fixed-term contracts. And fixed-term contracts in the Netherlands can be for up to 2 years, including the renewal. So it can be quite constraining and means that the employers should think twice before engaging employees on a fixed-term contract. There are some exceptions, however. If the employer can prove that there are particular interests of the company, so if they can prove that there are some specifically justified business needs, I think the next few years will be able to show what those business needs are, but it could be, for example, a trade secret that's very protected. One of the examples that we've found is if there's a Coca-Cola secret recipe, for example, that is something that could be an example. In Sweden, the High Court has awarded damages to an employee for excessive non-compete restrictions. You should be aware that in Sweden there is 60% financial compensation that is due to employees for non-competes. And what the High Court has ruled is that an employer cannot unilaterally change a clause that was unreasonable. So, again, I think the trend is to try and limit the habit of employers to excessively use non-competes. And now I'll hand over to Dan regarding confidentiality and trade secrets.
Thank you, Ming. Up to this point, we've been talking about contractual protections. But what happens if an employee doesn't have an agreement in place? Can the employer nevertheless protect its confidential information or trade secrets? And again, the approach in the U.S. is a matter of state law, but as a general matter, the answer depends on whether the employee is a former or current employee and on the type of information that the employer is trying to protect. In virtually every state during the employment relationship, employees have either a common law or a statutory duty not to use or disclose their employer's confidential information, regardless of whether or not the information rises to the level of a trade secret. But after the employment relationship ends, generally the former employee's obligations are greatly diminished. If the employer is trying to protect its trade secrets, there are plenty of legal protections available both during and after the employment relationship, regardless of whether there's a contract in place. But if the employer wants to protect run-of-the-mill confidential information that, while important, does not constitute a trade secret under applicable law, and if the employee is a former employee, then in that situation, the same protections generally don't exist, and rather in those situations, a non-disclosure agreement, or which I'll refer to as an NDA for short, is usually going to be needed in order to protect that run-of-the-mill confidential information. Now, that's the law in the U.S. Wan Li will discuss China in much greater detail in a few minutes. But while we're on this topic, Wan Li, can you tell us how the law in China compares?
Okay. Thank you, Dan. In China, the absence of the agreements, they do have a trade secret protect both during and after the employment. So, for example, there is no agreement, you have the protection. However, if it's any confidentials beyond the definition of a trade secret, that would not be protected, either during or after the employment. So I think it's a very important in relation to the confidential information, which is beyond the trade secret, then.
Thank you, Wan Li. Ming, how does the law in Europe compare?
Well, you rightly pointed out that when there's a clause for non-compete, then the employer is protected, and there is an obligation not to compete unlawfully during employment. But there can be, I guess, confidentiality clauses that are also inserted in the employment contract. But barring that, in the absence of any clauses, then the protection of employers are much smaller. There is an obligation. The duty of loyalty usually expires after the term of the employment contract. There is an obligation not to compete unfairly with the former employer, but that sort of limits situations where, for example, employers are being carrying out fraudulent activity, and so it's sort of understood that if they have a know-how, they can take that know-how with them onto their new employer. So the restrictions are would be limited to either what has been contractually agreed or a very narrow definition of trade secrets. And on that subject, it's probably a good idea to move on to the next slide and talk about the very recent development on confidentiality clauses in France. We issued an alert late last year on this topic, but it's an important development that when it comes to confidentiality clauses in France, you don't need to pay any financial compensation for such clauses to be lawful, unlike, as you will have understood now, the non-compete. So what it means is that to the extent that the courts don't consider that such a clause will prevent an employee from finding another job, it is quite a good idea for employers to carefully enclose confidentiality clauses in the agreement, bearing in mind that such confidentiality clauses will then carry on after the term of the employment contract. So I think on that topic, I'll now turn over to Dan regarding non-disclosure agreements.
Well, thanks, Ming. In a minute, I'll hand it over to Wan Li to talk about China in more detail. But before I do so, just to wrap up our discussion on NDAs and confidentiality, I think it might be helpful to set the stage by talking about the typical scope of an NDA in the U.S. And in the U.S., an NDA is typically going to have several different covenants that all work in tandem together. Typically, the NDA is going to have a covenant prohibiting the use or disclosure of trade secrets or other confidential information, even if the other information doesn't rise to the level of a trade secret under applicable law. Typically, there's going to be a covenant that requires the employee to return company property at the time of discharge. And it may also contain other restrictive covenants in addition to the non-disclosure, such as a non-solicitation of employees, a non-solicitation of customers, and even a true non-compete, again, depending on the state and whether true non-competes are enforceable. As I mentioned earlier, these agreements are generally governed by contract and governed by state law in the U.S. And depending on the state, the agreement is going to set out some basis for consideration, and that could be continued at-will employment. It could be something else. If the agreement is principally concerned about protection of information, the mere fact that the employee has received or will receive trade secrets or access to other confidential information may be sufficient consideration for the agreement. That's going to depend on state law. And perhaps most importantly for this discussion, a typical NDA in the U.S. will often include a mandatory choice of law and a mandatory forum selection clause. And we'll talk a little bit more about those at the end of the presentation today. But just for the moment, I want to flag that as an issue that we would typically see in NDAs in the U.S. Now, in general, regardless of what jurisdiction you're in, you should consider a few practical considerations when rolling out NDAs. And as an initial issue, what kind of sensitive information is the employee going to have access to? Is the agreement just going to cover information that belongs to the entity that's employing the employee? Or is the employee going to have access to information from other related companies, perhaps the parent or subsidiary? That ought to be spelled out in the agreement so it's clear what the scope of the protections are. And on a related note, to the extent feasible, the NDA should be tailored to the type of employee and the commercial environment. As an example, a salesman in an industry that's not particularly high tech is not likely to have access to the same kind of information as, say, somebody in research and development for a pharmaceutical company. It's going to be very different types of information that are at issue depending on the type of employee and the type of commercial environment. And so as the employer, this really is your chance to highlight the kind of information that you're trying to protect. The types of information should be spelled out clearly in the agreement that you're trying to protect. You might consider using a broad definition of the term confidential information, but then list some specific examples right in the agreement that you're trying or you're concerned about ensuring that are not disclosed. As with any other restrictive covenant, the NDA should spell out the consequences for a breach. Typically, that's going to include injunctive relief and damages. And also keep in mind, in the United States, parties that lose in litigation are not automatically required to pay attorney's fees of the prevailing party. And so if you have operations in the U.S., you ought to consider having a fee-shifting provision in the nondisclosure agreement. You'll also, along the same lines, want to consider in advance how feasible it's going to be for you to go into court to quickly enforce the NDA and get a temporary restraining order if necessary, keeping in mind that once information becomes public, you might forever lose the ability to protect it going forward. And finally, even apart from the NDA, you should consider some practical steps to ensure that employees return all company property at the time of the termination. Again, I'll discuss these practical steps in more detail at the end of the webinar, but you might want to consider having a checklist for HR and IT personnel to use with departing employees to ensure that everything else has been returned. Now, at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Wan Lee, but before I do, I have the CLE code for those of you who have been waiting for it. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form. The code is SS5263. That's SS as in Seyfarth Shaw, 5263. And now I'll hand it over to Wan Lee.
Thank you, Dan. On the latest developments in non-compete and trade secret law in China, I will first touch on the key points for non-compete, then the key points for the confidentiality in China, and then followed by the latest development in non-compete and trade secret law in China. Under the key points for the non-compete, non-compete maybe include in an employment contract, separate agreements, or collective bargaining agreement. Usually, people will put in the employment contract, and also usually we will advise that it should be non-compete should be introduced at the point of the hiring. After that, any employer want to introduce or sign the non-compete agreement, then you need to amend the contract, or you need to provide the consideration. If you don't have the non-compete agreement, then it will be very difficult to protect employers' interests. Just to give you a quick sort of example, recently, one of the U.S. company in China, they bid for a project with a competitor. At the time, the competitor was a lack of a sufficient technical engineering staff for the project. So that competitor then approached the U.S. company for the employees to join their company. And that U.S. company, because they don't have the non-compete agreements with all these technical or engineering employees, it will be very difficult for them to sort of restrict them because during their employment, they are subject to the non-compete. Once they resign and join a new company, the existing company will have the difficulty to enforce the non-compete. And in relation to the enforcement or to make the non-compete agreements enforceable, financial payment is required in China, and it becomes one of the key obligation on the part of the employer to perform or to enforce the non-compete agreement. If not pay, then the employees will have the right to terminate the non-compete agreement. Usually, reason for terminations does not impact non-compete. So as long as the non-compete agreement is valid, any reason for the termination of employment will not have an impact on the non-compete agreement. In China, it is relatively lenient towards the employer in the sense that no restriction for employer to withdraw or waive the non-compete at the terminations of the employment. On the other hand, employee does not have that right unless the employer failed to pay the compensation I just mentioned earlier. They need to pay the financial compensation or payment. For the non-compete agreement to be enforceable, it must be reasonable in duration. A couple of years ago, there was a confusion as to it should be 6 months, 12 months. Now it's sort of a settle that the employer can choose a half year, 12 months or 18 months, but the maximum you cannot be more than 2 years. In terms of geography, there should be a limit. There should be a reasonable ground. You cannot just worldwide or across a different country or jurisdiction. In terms of activity, got to be very relevant and closely related. Otherwise, the non-compete agreement will be challenged. Another element, this is very important in China because the language is a unique or different language. So it must be in the local language, of course, unless the employees are foreigner. So in that scenario, usually the bilingual non-compete agreements are required, because if there is a dispute, the Chinese version are still relevant in the labor arbitration committee or in the court. So usually Chinese language, if it's a foreign employee involved, then the bilingual. The justified in views of employees' role and seniority, this is very closely related to the first point, that we usually advise the U.S. company to have a non-compete agreement with their employee. In China, the law basically says the senior management's technical persons or people have confidential information. The last category is basically other staff who has the obligation to keep confidential regarding company's business. So the bar, in fact, is quite low, at least for the time being. On the confidentialities, it is also, it can be part of the employment contract, or it can be standalones or the collective bargaining agreement. One aspect is quite different from the non-compete agreement is that confidentiality clause or confidential agreement does not require any financial compensation to be lawful or enforceable. This is also a couple of years ago, I was confused that for any confidential clause to be enforceable, you need to be pay. Now, the rule is sort of fixed that there is no financial compensation is required. Different position if a non-confidential agreement, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of the trade secret, it doesn't matter during or after the employment agreement, you will get protected under the Chinese anti-unfair competition law. If any confidential information not within the scope of a trade secret, then if without the confidential agreement, then you need to look at whether the company have the relevant rules and the policy. If a yes, you still can get a protected. If a not, then during the employment period, you will be fine, but after the employment, it will be very difficult. The confidential agreements or clause does not prevent the employee from finding another job. That's one of the reasons that the Chinese law does not impose the financial compensation or payment. It is just imposed on the employee a duty to keep confidential information regarding company or company's business. In terms of a remedy in China, for any breach of a confidential obligation, there is an injunction, damage, or sometimes a penalty, or the quasi-penalty. There is a case in China. Previously, there is a requirement that damage must be reasonable and fair. So the judge usually look at the actual monthly salary of that particular employee, and also what the damage, actual damage that will be. And recently, the Chinese court in Shanghai basically says, in the situation where it is very difficult to calculate the actual damage, the court will enforce the amount agreed by the two parties. In that particular case, in fact, the damage is almost 20 times of that employee's monthly wages. It's almost equivalent to the penalty. Non-compete agreements and confidential agreements in China is quite related to each other. Today, non-compete agreement is widely used by the employer in China to protect their trade secret and confidential information. Because without the non-compete agreement, usually it will be very difficult for the existing or for the employer to prove that the ex-employee joined the competitors, and use the company's trade secret or confidential information, and also try to demonstrate the actual loss, it will be very difficult. But if you have the non-compete agreement together with the trade secret or confidential information agreement, then you can, as long as you can establish there is a breach of a non-compete, then it will be relatively easy to prove that particular employee, because who is or who hold the confidential information or trade secret, and they can demonstrate there is some link and also damage. Next one is latest case. It is more sort of reinforced the previous principle, and also sometimes there is a confusion in relation to consideration. As I mentioned earlier, in relation to the payment, a couple of years ago, some said there is you don't need to pay any financial payment. Some say yes, you need to pay. How much you need to pay? Some say 10%, some say 50%. And then the Chinese Supreme Court issued the judicial interpretation, which effectively says if there is no agreement in relation to the financial payment, but you have the non-compete agreement, then 30% of that particular employee's monthly wages should be pay. And then, of course, there's a different city, then read it in a different way. Some said 30% of the particular employee's base or monthly salary is the bottom line. You can agree to the high amount. In some cities, say no, it is in relation to there is a non-compete agreement, but without the clause about the financial payment. So you can agree a high amount or lower amount. For example, in Shanghai, 20% is valid and enforceable, but in Shenzhen, in southern part of China, they basically said 50%. So we need to be very careful that different city may impose a different rule. The right to termination, I already touched on that. Basically, employer has the right to withdraw or terminate the non-compete agreement at the beginning of the non-compete agreement coming into effect, that is, at the point of the termination of employment, or during the period of the non-compete agreement. But if the employer decided to terminate, then you need to pay 3 months of that particular employee's monthly pay to terminate the agreement anytime. Employee, on the other hand, does not have the right to terminate unless the employer failed to pay the financial compensation for 3 months. If it's less than 3 months, they cannot terminate the contract. New case regarding the trade secret injunction, it is very similar to the one last year in Shanghai. This is remarkable case. One key point we need to raise it is in the past, in whole China, more than a couple of hundred cities, only Shanghai's issued the injunction as a remedy for the trade secret breach. Now, in Anhui province, they follow exactly same rule and principle used in the Shanghai court. And then I will touch on the takeaway points, basically ensure the company has a non-compete agreement to rely on, properly define the claim in the non-compete agreement. Otherwise, there could be a dispute or challenge. Properly manage the enforcement of the non-compete agreements. It's basically you need to keep an eye on it, and also properly pay or the financial compensation on time. Ensure all the documents or relevant documents are marked with confidential or some data electronic information has a password protections or encrypted. Verify pre-employment vettings of IND staff. They are usually have a confidential information, the trade secret. Reviewing and update rule and policy regarding confidentiality and security arrangement. As I mentioned earlier, without the confidential agreement, but if you have a rule and a policy, it can still protect the company. Injunctive relief for trade secret infringement available in Shanghai and Anhui. We expect there will be further developments in that regard. Now I hand over to Means to talk about the trade secret and confidential information protection in Europe. Means.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Wang Li. Very briefly, as you know, there's a directive that's in preparation at the moment. The picture in Europe is that trade secrets is protected in a very different way across Europe. So there's a very laudable aim of the proposed directive to achieve harmonized rules. The directive has gone through different steps, and it will be debated in end of April in Parliament. So that will be able to be an opportunity to see how it's going to develop. But it's currently, I guess, in a state of flux. And the main achievements of the directive is that it will provide a harmonized definition of trade secret and information. There will be a limitation in terms of how long individuals can claim in case of breaches. It'll be between 1 and 2 years. The idea is that contractual rights, so what is in the confidential agreements, will still be valid. The trade secret won't change that, although it won't be possible for the countries to actually opt out. It will be a top-up. So very important to still keep in mind that the trade secret can be protected by way of a confidentiality agreement at the moment. And I think the things that you could be doing while we're waiting for the directive to go through, it's planned to go through sometime at the end of the year, but we'll keep you posted, of course, is to make sure that you are protecting your confidential information and making sure that you are severing confidential from non-confidential information in your organization. And Dan will probably be able to tell us much more about some other top tips for multinational employers.
Well, thanks again, Ming. We're running towards the end of our allotted time, so we'll just wrap up with a few more practical tips to consider in this space. And at the risk of stating the obvious, the first pointer I think that's important for companies to consider is that one size does not fit all. As a matter of necessity, most employers have to operate off template agreements, because there's simply no way to efficiently recreate the wheel for each employee. But having said that, templates should be the starting point for adjusting agreements, and agreements can and should be adjusted in order to comply with local situations and local laws. Now, the second pointer is that companies ought to consider choice of law and forum selection clauses and strategically consider filing enforcement actions in their home forum pursuant to a mandatory forum selection clause if they can obtain jurisdiction over the employee there. And the enforceability of forum selection clauses has been a particularly hot topic in U.S. non-compete litigation over the past few years. And that's largely as a result of a 2013 decision from the United States Supreme Court called Atlantic Marine Construction Company versus United States District Court for the Western District of Texas. And for those of you who are interested in the case citation, it's on the slide that you can see on your screen. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that as a matter of federal procedural law, federal courts should typically enforce valid forum selection clauses in all but the most extraordinary circumstances, even when the forum selection, the forum that the party selected is not the forum in which the employee resides and worked for the employer. Now, it doesn't appear, let me back up a second. Atlantic Marine did not concern restrictive covenant agreements and didn't even involve the employment context, but nevertheless, a number of federal courts have applied it in the non-compete context and held that employers could bring actions to enforce non-compete agreements in the forum that was agreed upon by the parties. It doesn't appear that there have been any reported decisions applying Atlantic Marine to non-compete agreements in the international context, but there are a handful of recent decisions that have applied the rule in employment cases that were not non-compete cases. Specifically, last year, two federal courts in New York enforced forum selection clauses that were in UK employment contracts with U.S. employees. And in those cases, the names and citations of which are on the screen, multinational employers employed U.S. citizens in the U.K. under U.K. employment contracts, and those contracts had provisions that stated that the parties submitted all disputes to the courts in the U.K. Now, despite these valid forum selection clauses, after the employees were discharged, they attempted to sue their employers in federal court in New York, citing U.S. anti-discrimination statutes. And in both cases, the federal courts in New York held that the forum selection clauses controlled and that the employees could not bring suits in the U.S. as the U.K. was the party's agreed-upon forum. And so in both of those situations, the federal courts dismissed the U.S. litigation and said to the employees that if they needed to proceed or wanted to proceed, they needed to proceed in the U.K. Now, again, these cases didn't involve non-compete agreements, but the reasoning that the courts applied arguably would be just as applicable in the non-compete context as it was in the discrimination context. And for this reason, multinational employers should consider strategically using forum selection clauses with the caveat that the Atlantic Marine rule applies only to federal courts in the U.S. and does not apply to courts in other jurisdictions or indeed even to state courts in the U.S. Another important practical tips that employees should consider is carefully considering the logistics of rollout and consideration of their agreements. As we discussed earlier, what's required for valid consideration varies even within the U.S. from state to state and certainly is going to vary in other jurisdictions. And so it's important for employers to get advice from counsel about what the applicable rules are as they're rolling out these agreements. Another important consideration is to periodically review and update non-compete agreements and other agreements, particularly when employees receive a promotion or when they receive a pay increase. Many employers probably have experienced a situation in which they want to attempt to enforce a non-compete against a departing employee and then go back and look at the personnel file and find out that the non-compete is 20 years old and that it doesn't match, or the restrictions don't match what the employee has been doing for the past 15 years. In order to avoid that situation, it's important for employers to roll out new agreements in jurisdictions where they can roll out new agreements with existing employees as situations change over time. One other practical consideration that we already touched on earlier today, but it's important to implement procedures to ensure that employees return all company property at the time of the termination. I already mentioned using a checklist. Conducting exit interviews and reminding employees of their continuing obligations can also be helpful steps. As needed, companies might also consider sending reminder letters to the departing employees and to their new employers. And you might also consider including a provision in an agreement that requires employees to provide written certification of their compliance with the covenants for some reasonable period of time, obviously depending on whether that is permitted in the jurisdiction in which you're operating. Also, as appropriate and provided that it's compliant with local privacy laws, a forensic examination of employees' computers, email, and devices can be a very helpful tool to monitor compliance at the time that an employee departs. And finally, to quote Ben Franklin, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. At risk of stating the obvious, all employers can and should take common sense measures to ensure that their assets are protected. That could include things like storing hard copies in locked closets, limiting the ability of employees to print sensitive documents, limiting access to the truly important documents, the crown jewels, to employees who legitimately have a business need for that, for access to those kind of documents, monitoring access and use of IT resources, provided that you can do so consistent with applicable privacy laws, and also things like encrypting data and putting password protections on documents. Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but we trust this presentation has been helpful. And for more information and to keep up with these issues, please do check out our blog at www.tradesecretslaw.com. And because this is a pre-recorded webinar, we can't take any live questions today. But if you have any questions at all, please don't hesitate to reach out to any of today's speakers. On the final slide, you'll find contact information for us. We'd love to hear from you if you have any comments or questions. Thank you very much.
And thank you to our speakers. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending. And is everybody all set and happy with that recording before I hit the stop button?
I think you can hit the stop button.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Hold on.